Yeah, got it. Sounds good. All right. Thank you, everyone, for coming to this panel discussion. This afternoon, we're going to talk about prioritizing IT security projects for the business. That's something that's pretty near and dear to my heart. Understanding how to prioritize IT security, how to get the business involved in risk, and understanding how to make that something that you get the whole business engaged with. The moderator this afternoon is Steve Baroni. He's the Chief Executive Officer for CBI, which is a cybersecurity risk management company. And Steve Baroni.
Thanks. Thank you. It's fun to be here and watch Converge grow. A couple of years ago, they were at Wayne State, and it was the first significant investment we've made in Converge, and the partnership continues to grow and grow and grow. I think it's better here, don't you? I mean, if you've gone to the other ones, it was easy. We moved the company downtown, and it was easy to take the people mover over and get off the people mover and use it for something other than a Red Wing game. And without drinking, actually, like we had done at most of those. So anyways, fun to be here, fun to invest back in Converge and watch the group get a little bigger and broader. We're trying to bring a business acumen to Converge. So we love the technical side of it, and most of us are technical, although in my case a little rusty, but we're trying to bring the business side to Converge a little bit so you can understand why we do what we do and when we do what we do. Today, asking these very esteemed leaders of the IT community to sit with us and figure out and pick their brain as to why they decide to work on projects at a certain time helps answer the question of, hey, why aren't you guys more secure? Why don't you fix all of this right now? And it's just something that can't be done, and we're going to ask them questions based on that. So some good news, the Verizon data breach report is out, Symantec's internet security threat report is out, Gartner just updated and released the Magic Quadrants, and the good news is, boy, are we in the right growth industry, right? I mean, there is money coming in like crazy, there are problems like crazy, and there are really innovative companies doing amazing things to help us get control of the security infrastructure. This means that groups and people like you can continue to invest in your career and understand that this thing is going to be going on for a while. The bad news that's in a lot of that same reports is, boy, is cyber espionage on the rise. It's now, I remember when we started doing security, CBI has been around 26 years, and we were a think tank for 20 of those years. And I can remember when we left our remote access routes at the end of the 90s and began to focus on keeping people out rather than letting people in, how tough it was for people to care about computer security. And we would warn them of things like cyber espionage, even though we knew it probably wasn't going to happen. Well, there is no thinking it might happen anymore. It's going to happen. Your business is going to get hit in some way, shape, or form, and how you prepare for it is how you're going to deal with the consequences. So here's some of the things we've seen. 300% increase in targeted phishing attacks. The phishing attacks are getting really, really good. The other day, I got an email from Delta. I haven't flown as much the last couple years, so I wasn't diamond anymore with Delta. And I got an email saying, congratulations on your mid-year diamond upgrade. And I'm like, that's awesome. So I didn't think about it because it came from e.delta.com. I opened it up. Turns out, after about 2 days of wrangling with Jason Brown, who runs CBI Labs, it was a legitimate email. E.delta.com made me feel decent about it. Jason confirmed it was. Delta made a mistake. they had applied some miles to a bunch of people they shouldn't have applied miles to, and we were all notified erroneously that, no, you're not. You're still at the bottom. You're not diamond. So we're seeing an increase in phishing attacks across the board. Economic espionage, such as spyware, stealing trade or commercial secrets, or ransomware, remain a consistent threat. And some adversaries are no longer relying on malware, and everybody's a target. If you've been in this industry for a while, you've got individuals you know that have probably had ransomware as a factor, and you've got small business friends that have ransomware that's hit them, and we've all seen the middle size and larger companies get hit with ransomware, and those are getting more complex. So Today, we're going to talk to this crew about how they're handling all the threats that are hitting their businesses and how they're prioritizing what to go after and knock down in the year. If you spend time in corporate America talking to decision makers like these guys, you know that they've got a board somewhere. You've probably seen it. And that board is full, baby. I mean, it is full of stuff that they want to get to. And they're trying to figure out the most logical path to appeasing all the stakeholders to get there. So we're going to dig into that a little bit today. So with me today are Martin Bailey, the VP and CSO of Diebold Nixdorf, David DeRogatis, the Corporate Vice President for Burns and Wilcox, John Scrivens, the Global Category Manager for Harman, Russ Gordon, the Global IT Risk Manager for BorgWarner, and John Bisco, the CISO for CBI. All right, so quite a group that we got here today to talk to Converge. And I think it lends a lot of credibility to where Converge is going as a show that guys like this are here today. I'll start this off with you, Russ. How do you typically work? In a perfect world, you've got that board, and you've got all the stuff you got to go get done. And you pretty much know that the board's bigger than the year. How do you work with other stakeholders in IT, networking, server, architecture, ops guys, to get cybersecurity projects prioritized and have them not get in the way?
I don't know if this is working. There you go.
So the first thing I do is try and make sure that they all get involved and get engaged with the project. The more you can get them,
on board and feel like they have a piece of the action, the more you're going to get them to work on your projects. Sometimes you can get them to work on things on your board that you wouldn't normally get to because they get excited about it. And so you can kind of give them a piece of your board while you're working on something else. So that's kind of how I do it, is try to make it exciting and fun and not just bark orders to people and tell them, this is how I want it because I'm in charge of security. I let them have a piece of the action.
Thanks. John Scrivens, what about you? With Diebold, how do you handle the politics? Pardon me? Oh, sorry. That's what I knew that. Sorry. And I'll do that probably over and over again, John, with Harman. How do you deal with the some of the inner politics that go along with getting the different stakeholders on board?
Yeah, so that's an interesting aspect in any position. It has to come down to the stakeholders that are involved in prioritizing the return on any specific project or application solution set that you're looking to bring in, identifying what the risk and what the rewards are into doing that. Obviously, you need to present it in such a way that we're all one team, and what is the ultimate solution that we're trying to get to. That's where I think in the course of time, the right solution will bubble up and meet the, agreement with all the stakeholders. But it's never an easy process. You always have various opinions on what's going to be right, and in the end, usually it's dictated by the cost and what's required.
All right, so Martin from Diebold. Diebold's a big company, and you've got your board giving you pressure to get some things done. You've got various C-levels giving you pressure to get things done. What's the process of engaging with the various business leaders to knock down the mandates that have to happen for Diebold in a calendar year?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question. And I tell you, you have to make sure that security is kind of known in the organization. You need to build relationships. And the way we approach it at Diebold Nixdorf is that we set up a governing council where we have functional representation from the business. We have probably about 15 members. And you have it for regions, and we have it for business functions, finance, HR, everything. And that's an opportunity that we could talk about risk for the organization, and as we're driving change, and we can understand the impact when we're doing things. And if there's any initiative that's a global risk that can affect the whole business, right? We have all these stakeholders that now have some education and awareness, and they help promote it. So, that's their opportunity, the business's opportunity to tell me a say in security and how we implement it, and actually them to start owning some of those processes and areas of change. And I think a good example is, let's say, with data protection or HR, right? Driving some different requirements in hiring or what have you. We would then take, you know, in our council, we would just communicate that, kind of communicate the risk. And the stakeholders, traditionally, they'll volunteer up, and yeah. they'll even volunteer resources.
All right, thanks. On that same note, let me ask you one follow-up question on that. How much of a hindrance is existing infrastructure to you getting things done? And what I mean by that is you've got these stakeholders now, you get them aboard, and we see big picture items affecting security across the spectrum. We all want to go after them. You've been at Diebold now for how long?
7 months.
7 months. So how much of a problem in terms of getting what you want to get done is the existing infrastructure you take on?
So if I understand correctly, you're saying the challenge of getting initiatives completed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you that it's tricky because it depends what's going on in your business, right? Because you have business objectives that are highest priority, right? And kind of we had these guiding priorities, my team. It's to support the business. Second one is integration. The third is to deliver to our roadmap and goals, meaning the business always comes first,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really mapped to kind of where the business is going, what initiatives are driving. Us is right now it's transformation, right? We're taking from a traditional ATM point of sale business to more software and services. So anything that's related to those big initiatives, if there's security drivers or security need to be involved, we're putting more so resources and effort in those initiatives because the business sees the return and we build better relationships with the business.
Yeah, good.
So,
thank you.
Yep. And I think what your question is really is when you have an initiative, let's say rolling out some system or doing something, you know, a lot of times, you know, you're not going to deliver to your timeline, right? We're almost always late, right? Because there's always things that come up. And I think the key is not losing sight of it. You always have to come back and finish it. A lot of the tools in our portfolio only implemented like 30-40% of what capabilities they have. We always jump to the next tool. So we have to have a mechanism to come back and finish up.
I mean, that's a great point. David, let me ask you a little bit different role there. Coming from Burns & Wilcox, a major player on the insurance side, you see third-party risk in a huge way. And Burns & Wilcox is being asked to be an aggregator, if I understand it completely right, and I don't, but an aggregator for cyber insurance for many of them. So you're privy to a lot of the third-party companies out there that have all these issues. What's the most prevalent issue you see with regards to cyber insurance right now and what you see from security infrastructure from these smaller companies?
The biggest thing is there's a lack of understanding of what a cyber insurance policy can do. I think if you look in the news, there's constant media attention, as everybody knows. But a lot of people think it's a hacker breaking into a company, and somebody may be getting sued from a bank or some type of class action. We saw with Home Depot just recently the class action lawsuit that was brought against them from all of the banks totaled nearly $30 million. They also had a derivative lawsuit as well that would hit the D&O insurance. But cyber insurance opens up an entire new opportunity to the IT department, to helping the budget of every single organization that's out there. Cybersecurity insurance can provide resources to the IT department if there is a breach. So in addition to just writing the check for a ransomware attack, it will pay to have somebody come in and restore the data, restore the system. It will pay IT overtime cost in the event of a data breach. It will pay for leased space if you have to bring in new servers or if you have to go to another location to try to restore your operations. It does so much more than most organizations realize, and having that type of insurance in place allows every organization to have a buffer so that they can reallocate their budget for projects for cybersecurity internally, so that if something does happen, the cyber insurance policy is going to allow other resources, other vendors to come in and help mitigate the situation.
I asked the others on the panel, how are you getting affected by mandates regarding cyber insurance internally? Are you getting pushed down from anywhere that the board or executives are worried about your posture for cyber insurance, and is that part of your day-to-day? Anybody?
At this time, we've started looking at something like that.
Okay.
We haven't really gone that very far with it. Obviously, we've made some huge investments in solutions and in hardware and software, but I think it's obviously something that's going to grow substantially in the years to come as it helps mitigate that risk that you can't account for in just solutions by themselves.
Yeah, we're starting to see banks not willing to loan money unless you get to a certain cyber rating position. We're starting to, or if you're, it looks just like a credit rating. If your ranking's low, your loan limit's low, or you're going to pay interest that's high. We're starting to see it in the insurance sector, where they're coming back to us and saying, hey, these guys want cyber insurance, but can you tell us how their infrastructure looks? And if it's this level, maybe. And if it's this level, maybe with some money. And if it's this level, yeah, you look great. And it started off as a smaller business thing, but we're seeing it moving upwards now and affecting the bigger boys and the bigger players. So that's interesting. Thanks for the feedback on that. Going back to you, Russ, take 2 minutes to talk about how your business currently looks at IT security projects prioritized into the overall spend.
So we do a analysis every year, enterprise risk management, that encompasses more than just IT, but a big part of it is IT. And we look at where our risks are, and we focus on that with those risks, and we kind of look at kind of a roadmap where we like to take things, and we do it over a 3-year period, because I think anything over 3 years, you kind of need to reevaluate because the technology and the risks change so often. But we do a risk analysis over about 3 years, and we look where our risks are, and we kind of put forth those risks, regardless of cost. We put forth what those risks are. And then once we take that to the executive board, the C-level, we kind of, I wouldn't say scare them, but we kind of let them know of what risks they have. They don't want to be the next people, the next company that's in the Wall Street Journal, you know, complaining that they were hacked. So they find a way to spend the money and give us the money. And it's for us, it's never been a problem, or my problem, getting dollars for projects. For me, it's resources. So I think there's a separate distinction, because a lot of times there's OPEX and there's CAPEX. And a lot of times companies have more operating than they have capital, or vice versa. And so they don't want to add the resources you need, and they'll let you bring on technology. Eventually, you're going to need to bring on people to work those programs. But we kind of, like I said, after we do that risk analysis and then we find the right tools, and hopefully we have the right resources for it, and then we take a look at what the normal IT spend is, the IT budget, and we look at, you know, we try to stay industry average, probably about 1-2% of the total IT spend is on security.
Martin, can I ask you the same question?
So it's exactly what Russ was saying, and we use a number of different inputs, right? One is really kind of where threats are going in our vertical, right? And then we look at what specific projects or technologies, what demands we're getting from the business, right? And what are really mapped up to the strategic roadmap of the business. Those are a couple inputs we look at. And and also the risk assessment, which is really important. And then I think a fourth input that we look at is what tools are in our portfolio that aren't working, that aren't delivering, that we already put enough investment in, and that we have to sundown, because it's that lifecycle management of those things, because they still reside, right? And there's still some effort to maintain them, and we could reduce the amount of, we could increase the amount of capacity we have if we just sundown those tools that aren't effective anymore. So those are kind of the four things
we
look at.
I appreciate that. John Bisco, as we listen to the prioritized spend for security from these companies, these large companies, we know that one of the ongoing issues we're dealing with is the vetting of third-party suppliers, right? What's your opinion on the danger there and the corporate attention and spend being placed on it? Where's that going?
Well, the danger is getting much worse. It's as our adversaries are trying and bumping up against our defenses on the corporate side, they're finding our third parties as being that easier target to go after. I think the most prevalent and widely known example is the Target breach. And so, you know, when you look at your third parties, you have to start evaluating them along the same lines that you're evaluating your own internal risk assessment. Martin mentioned, you know, his risk assessment that he performs at his organization. At my prior organization, we had the same thing. We would tier our third parties. We look at all of them, from catering all the way up through our core service providers. We would look at what services they're providing to us, and we would risk rank them. We would have different levels of and gates of analysis that we would do based on the service they were providing to us, the impact that it would have to us in case something happens. So I think we're seeing more and more of that, and I think that's the direction that we're going to continue to go down. As we reinforce ourselves, we've got to start pushing some of that risk analysis back on our providers.
John Scrivens, how does that affect you? You've got, not only does Harman have a lot of suppliers, you just went through a massive acquisition, and you're dealing with that now on a global scale that's even bigger than it was before. How much of a problem is that?
I think it's more of a problem with just processing the sheer number of suppliers that we have and identifying what those risks might be. For me, it's about aligning with the best suppliers in each expertise of a specific area. When you start getting off that road, you just don't know what you're getting into. So really, I try to focus on the name brands, the ones that are in the Gartner reports, the Forrester reports, and the ones that someone has brought in through some division or some small spend. We try to pull those out and consolidate away from them.
Dave, let me ask you the same question. So you're insuring these companies, and third party, you can insure all day long. And without a verification process or name brand is good, but Target used name brand people, and Target, an HVAC company came in and created all the damage. What are you doing with regards to third-party verification or third-party quality, I guess, of security infrastructures out there?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because with cyber insurance, it can be extremely technical, just as cybersecurity and the IT side is. And insurance carriers, brokers, they try to boil it down so that the underwriting process is as simple as possible. On the cyber insurance side, you'd be shocked at the minimum number of questions that are asked in order to generate a premium and to provide a policy to somebody. So on the small to mid-size, and I'm talking about $100 million in revenue and under, there are typically 6 questions that are asked in terms of generating a problem or generating a premium and doing a full risk analysis. Now, it depends on the type of industry that you're in. If you're in the banking sector, if you're an insurance plan, if you're a data aggregator, it becomes a little bit more in-depth with regards to the underwriting, the overall risk analysis, but it's surprisingly simple. Probably 5 years ago, there was a 5-page application and a 10-page application that every organization had to complete in order to apply and qualify for cybersecurity insurance. But now it's been boiled down to 1 page, 6 questions, and the brokers that really focus on it, the insurance companies that really focus on it, they've brought it down to a science. So the amount of evaluation is very limited when it comes to providing a premium on those small to mid-sized organizations.
Yeah, it's pretty much the honor system, isn't it?
It almost is the honor system.
I just heard today, by the way, the queue line is going to be based on the honor system. Did you see that? You're going to buy a ticket, and they're not going to take the ticket, but they're going to randomly check for tickets. Let's see how that works out, right? Let's see how that works after the course of about a month or so.
But Steve, if I can just add this is what I'll say. Insurance companies are starving for information, for actuarial data, because relatively speaking, on the insurance side, cyber insurance is a very young product. Compared to other property and casualty lines. So insurance companies are looking to have more robust data that they can use to properly evaluate and assign the right premium with the risk. That's something that everybody's working on right now.
Okay, let's switch up a little bit. Let's talk about the cloud. Just when we think we're getting our act together and we learn old school how to make things more secure across the board. It's fun to watch two-factor making such a big comeback, isn't it? Something that we knew would make a big impact a long time ago, and having it hang out up in the cloud. Hello to the Duo people if you're here. You're awesome. The cloud. How do cloud initiatives help or hinder your ability to move more initiatives into place? And anybody that wants to answer it.
I mean, I can.
Do they help? Do they hinder? What do the cloud initiatives do to your general thinking? Because the cloud's offerings are changing at a pretty rapid clip, and so are the threats.
Yeah, we have over 2,000 cloud implementations now, and it's escalating every day. It's hard to even keep up with it, both in just management of it and onboarding and validating. But that's where the business is going. And I guess going back to my previous answer and kind of in line with cloud, it's hard to spend a lot of time validating all these suppliers. Yeah. So ultimately, it comes down to what's in your contract. What risk are you taking on? What risk are they going to take on? And ensure there's a clear line of delineation between the risk that you have and the risk that the supplier's going to take on. And you can spend all the time you want trying to validate a supplier or confirm what their policies are. At the end of the day, it's going to be illegal.
How closely are you working with data loss technologies to protect data up in the cloud? John, you could actually take that question on and talk about what some options are, perhaps, in that space.
Well, I think what, just to step back on Darman John, and I'll hit on the DLP side, but what the cloud has provided is the ability for the business lines themselves to go out and find their own IT solutions. You know, the term shadow IT has really come about because of the whole migration to the cloud. And going back to, I think, something Martin said very early on, the role of the security officer, the security manager, is to foster relationships with those lines of businesses. Make sure that you're in and you have that good relationship working with them so that you understand what their priorities are. If it's not a solution that's going to be delivered by IT, but instead they're going to go out and find it on their own, make sure that you're partnering with them so that you can be part of that risk analysis phase, even if they're going directly to the cloud. As far as the DLP comes with, you start with contracts, you start figuring out, making sure you know up front, what information are you taking? I remember back to an early cloud initiative I had at my previous employer, and in reviewing the data feed that they were going to be getting from us, they were getting all kinds of information that had nothing to do with the actual service that they're providing to us. It was just part of the core dump that was coming out of the original system, and it was just easier. Instead of paring that down, instead of reducing the amount of fields that we were sending, they just took it all. So I'd say start first and foremost with making sure you understand what is it that you're giving up to that cloud provider, and then you go with the rest of that risk assessment process of validating what they're doing with it.
Everybody's today, I don't know if we've surrendered to the point where we come from an environment where data used to be in one place, and then data was on a desktop and a file server, and then file servers, and then data was on laptops and such. And now data's everywhere. Data's absolutely everywhere. We've tried every trick in the book to make sure we lock data in. But because of the cloud initiatives and because of things as simple as Dropbox and the different ways email can beat various systems, we've got data all over the place. How much of that is a problem for you right now? Anybody here on the board, and what are you doing about it?
I can say that's actually a huge problem and one of the things that does keep me up at night, because at the end, it is all about the data and where it is. With the consumerization of IT, all the different technologies, Internet of Things, you can't keep your data in one place. It's everywhere. And so you have to prioritize what that data is, where your crown jewels are, and put some rules around it. Maybe not everything that you have is going to go into the cloud. Maybe some things you have to ring fence and mandate that it stays in-house. Or you put technologies around it that either help you put a wrapper around it so you can keep control of who's reading it, who's printing it, who's copying it, and who, you know. Otherwise, if you're just throwing everything out there, you can't, once it leaves your perimeter, you're done. You can't control it. So cloud is actually changing the way we do security at our company. Like I said, every 3 years we kind of reevaluate what we're doing. Well, now because of cloud and because of the say millennial workforce that we're now gathering, people don't want to work traditionally anymore. They don't want to stay in the office and work. They want to work from home. They want to work from Starbucks. And so we have to start putting security at the data level and at the endpoint level, because we can't put it at the perimeter level anymore because people are not staying in one place.
That's exactly right. Martin, I know you wanted to answer this, right?
You know, with data protection, to be honest, right, you really have to look at data classification. What's the value of the data and what's the impact to the business if it's in the wrong hands? And once you get that, because you know, you understand, you have to understand the workflow. Where does that data need to reside? Because we focus a lot in like data in transit and data at rest, but the problem is that data goes, you know, outside our managed devices, right? It's going to go on a home PC, on a mobile phone, you know, sent through email, and areas that we don't manage. So I think, you know, a lot of people talk about DLP, but I think that's going to evolve into more of like a DRM or IRM solution, where the actual data itself is going to be encrypted and wrapped, and you're going to need to have the right type of keys to access it at all times, right? And I think that's where it's going to change into. Because with DLP, you can get some rule sets and understand, you know, you really need to know the business process to know what rules. Can you send this email out? Is this technician allowed to put that on a USB or not, right? There's always going to be deviations. So really, I think the future is encrypting everything, and if you're an employee, you'll have access to it, and then you'll start shrinking pockets. Say finance can access finance data, engineering can access engineering data. So I think that's where we're going to evolve to, probably real soon here.
So we did a thing about a year and a half ago. I think we asked a couple of the guys that are up here some questions. We said, hey, what's your encryption posture? What are you doing as a company? What's it look like from cradle to grave? Can you explain it to me? And I was surprised, but then again, not surprised because of how busy we all are, how everybody had a grasp on encryption in pockets in the company, but not an encryption picture overall. We built an encryption assessment led by Wolfgang Gorlick, and we did it for several companies here in the Southeast Michigan area and looked at their encryption game plan over the next 5 years, what was already there, what we're dealing with, and what might go back out the door. And everybody wants it, but everybody also understands the complexity of it. And nobody wants to be the guy to put the end user in a position where they're inconvenienced, perhaps, with all the complexities behind encryption. So we know it's a big play, and we talked to all Gemalto and Duo and PKware and a lot of the guys that are doing some funky, cool encryption plays, and we're finally seeing encryption be able to happen on the fly with technologies transparent enough in some of the ways we do it. And I would agree with you, we think that along with things like two-factor are a significant play in protecting your data, so I appreciate that. On that note, and knowing that we got data all over the place, what's the biggest hurdle or two you have today in moving some security projects forward inside? What are you facing as one of your bigger hurdles besides budget? Anybody?
I'll just say real quickly, you know, there's two main things. One is capacity, right? Because there's just so much work out there. And also managing capacity with intrusiveness to the business, right? Because you cannot just make a big bang. If you implement some new technology, it has to be in a crawl, walk, run mentality. Because if you introduce some new technology, it's going to be seen as intrusive. It could break business processes. And once you get that bad rep with the business, it's going to be hard for future projects. So it's really kind of understanding that you're going to take, you know, it's going to take time, right, to get something through. And then is really the resources, right? Because you can always get, you know, consulting dollars and get people in, but in some regards, a lot of times they don't know the business, and the business wants to work with people that they deal with all the time, right, that they're seeing every day. So that's kind of the challenges that we see right now.
Yeah, thank you. Anybody else on that? John Scrivens?
Yeah, I guess I would kind of agree with that and say that I look at the security proxies as being value preservation, where you're trying to preserve the value of the company, and a lot of the products that we get involved with are value creation, and in your constantly fighting that battle of, am I doing something that's increasing revenue or am I doing something that's preserving revenue? And that's quite often the trade-off. And I, thinking back to the previous question too, you know, a lot of it's governance policy that you establish. We're faced constantly with a lot of the cloud solutions not being enterprise type solutions where just anyone can call up with a PayPal account or a corporate card and sign up for an account, and before you know it, you've got data moving somewhere you're not even aware of, and it is trying to address those situations, and that's where I say trying to align ourselves with robust cloud solutions that are set up for enterprises and not, you know, smaller solutions that really haven't have that ability to be robust in a, not just an account perspective, but also in how they interact with the corporation and what kind of contracts they provide.
So I think for me, I've always been nervous that I picked the wrong technology. There's so many technologies out there that, and I get phone calls every single day to the fact that I don't even answer my phone anymore because there's 20 different people a day who want to sell you a technology that you may or may not need. And then how do you pick the one? How do you pick the one that you want to do that's going to solve your problem? Not one technology is going to solve all of your problems. So you kind of sit there and you're afraid to make a move because you pick one and you get behind it, but then something else happens and then your boss or some other company manager comes up to you and says, well, didn't we have something to protect against that? So I think knowing that we don't have the budget, knowing that, you know, we have to pick something. I think you mentioned earlier that you look at the Gartners and things like that in the upper right quadrants. You generally can't go wrong with those, but I think you have to take a couple things into account. One, if you're not going to solve the whole problem, you have to pick at least one of the two of the problems that you can fix and at least focus on that. After you do that, and then you have to reevaluate and see what's the next project that I'm going to work on. But knowing you're not going to hit a home run or hit it out of the park with the first project and spend the only spend that you have, It's a continual effort, and you have to reevaluate. And sometimes you might get rid of a product that you just bought because you found something that's really going to solve your problems. But to me, that's always been the struggle is finding the right tools to fit the business and making sure that it was the right decision.
Yeah, for me, it always comes down to resources. In the big picture, the money is the easy part. You might have to go through multiple board presentations. You might have to present to try to get the funding approved. But once that's done, finding the bodies to help you deliver, it's always been a challenge, whether it's within my own team in security, whether it's within the IT teams that you always have to get involved, because no matter what security control you're putting in place, you're usually going to need someone from IT or IT ops to help you roll that out. And then you've got to compete on the business side. You know, Steve, you mentioned it, a lot of these things impact the day-to-day work of our peers, of our employees, of our colleagues within our organization. And they care about security, but really what they care about is doing their job and getting their job done successfully. And the whatever change we're trying to put in is going to disrupt their day. And we're being viewed as someone who's making their lives more difficult. So we're competing for their mind share to make sure that they're listening to our education, listening to our training, and getting them involved to buy in and actually changing their behavior to do it the way that we're asking them to. So for me, it's always been about resource and getting their attention.
So on all that note, all of that makes sense to me. As Russ, when you were talking, I was thinking about, we feel the same way, by the way. As a consulting company, we've got a different company knocking on our door every hour to come show us how they've conquered endpoint security. And we do what you do. We look at a Gartner Magic Quadrant and say, well, no one's going to get fired for looking at the products up here. And then we begin to look at their investment in long-term planning and say, hey, is this worth a spin to put it back to John's group, back to Jason's group, to go do a deep dive eval on it for 90 to 180 days. How important right now for anybody up here is, how difficult is it for a smaller vendor or a new start that's a single product vendor to crack your company? When we consolidation of vendors in this world we're talking about is a better way if you can trust the data. So, for example, and I'll give you a couple examples. Tanium and CrowdStrike and others have come after the endpoint the last couple of years very aggressively with solid products. But when you're with one of the stalwarts, you've got a comprehensive platform and more of a single throat to choke. How much of a factor is that as you're buying?
For us, like you said, you're never going to get fired for looking at the top right, but it really depends on the risk that you're facing or that we're facing. If we're willing to take a chance, say on a smaller company, smaller play, they have to solve the problem first and foremost. And for me, I need to get information from, say, other companies that they've delivered work to make sure that they've said or they do what they say they can do. I'm a little nervous working with those first startups. Working in manufacturing, from a security standpoint, we're never going to be on the bleeding edge of security. So generally, we're not working with those first early startups trying to prove a technology. We're going to always go with something tried and true. So for me, it's hard to get the small newcomers involved.
Thank you.
We deal a lot with small newcomers. I rely a lot on CBI just in understanding what the secret sauce is behind the scenes a lot of times on some of those new ones. I look at the security layer as various layers. We rely on the larger players to answer, you know, probably a big portion of that space. But then there's always areas where a small player will come in and do something new, something different that can add value. And that's really what it comes down to. Can they come in, provide for, you know, a reasonable value, some level of protection or security in an area that we're missing.
Thank you.
I'd just like to add, I think, you know, traditionally, if you look at companies, we used to rely heavily on procurement. In a sense, they would do some type of assessment on a vendor, right? Look at the financials, look at longevity of the company, right? All these different things before you can be considered to do business. I think that's opened up a lot. And when you think about all the big players in the market today and how they're buying these startups, and you see like some, you know, I don't want to pick at a vendor because I don't want to get in trouble, but if they buy something and now they want to sell it to you, right? And then it didn't work out after 3 years, and then, you know, you made an investment and then it didn't work out, and they're no longer developing and maintaining that service. And that happens so much, and that's from the big players, right? So I think for me, you know, as our businesses are being driven to transform with digitalization and things, fail fast, that we're more open to look at those small guys, get in early, because they could be the next big thing. And we want to get in at a competitive price early on and kind of lock in, right? So we're really looking at smaller companies, you know, and allowing them an opportunity to come and talk with us.
And I think that's a little bit of a lesson for those of us in the room. Dave and I have been going to RSA forever and a day, and we joked that back in the formative years of security, some of our best times were walking the very, very back couple of rows with the 10x10 booths with the guys that had the coolest stuff we had seen, and wondering how we might take that to some of the big guys and take a shot on them after a vetting process. So it's good to hear that there's still some open-mindedness there and that you trust your companies like CBI to help you make a decision on some of that technology. I have time for one more question. I want to ask each one of you this, and I know it's important for the people at Converge because a lot of these guys here are colleagues or they're trying to work for you or they're trying to talk to you about business. To each of you, how do you stay current on threats and trends? What are you reading? What are you doing? Who do you rely on?
Being on the insurance side, I have the privilege and opportunity to work with a number of leading international insurance companies that are in the forefront, that are paying claims, they're involved in industry segments of all sizes, of all varieties. So I stay very tight with our insurance company partners that we manage programs with, that we broker business out to. So being in the know with them on claims, on the data, types of losses that they're seeing, how their policy is responding, you know, that's how I stay in the know.
You know, it's a combination of different things, to be honest with you. I mean, there's this global threat intelligence, right? And what does that really mean? And, you know, is it about attacks? Is it about new technology? What have you? So personally, I subscribe to a lot of things. And I pick things that are kind of business related because I tell you, there's two aspects of it. One is for the program itself and for my team. And the other one is, what is the CEO going to ask me when he sees something in the news, right? Do we have protection for this? Or are we doing something like for that? So, I spend a good portion of my mornings, to be honest with you, first hours kind of going through everything that's kind of in the news early in the morning, like 4 a.m. Because when I come in, I want to make sure I don't get blindsided. And then from a technical perspective, there's partnerships with like CBI and other people that kind of introduce new things. The partners that we do have, like if it's Manic or someone else, we kind of say, hey, we get the executives in, we want to talk with them. What's your strategic roadmap, right? Where do you see this product coming in? Where is it going to be at the end of the year? What new technology and functionality, and where does it line up with our roadmap and capabilities we want to offer?
I just want to make a quick comment, and that is, if you get up early in the morning and be friends with partners like this, that's how I stay current. I'm looking for
them. At 4 a.m.
That's right.
Anybody else, John or Russ?
Yeah, I think it's a matter of perspective, and I think, you know, there's always the reading that you can do. Is companies like CBI that can add some insight. There's even your own suppliers that have a lot of wisdom in what they do. And so it's a matter of bringing all those perspectives together and kind of formulating your own opinion of how that's going to affect your company.
You kind of have to be well-rounded in your reading. You get it from all over the place, from your CNNs, from your threat reports you have from your tools. You get it from the Wall Street Journal, again, from that business side, because you will get asked from the C-suite of what's happening. Because when they read it, they're generally going to have questions, and they're going to come after you for the answers. So there's probably not one source of information. I do get a lot of information from security vendors, from partners such as CBI. But generally, anything big enough, I'm also a member of the partnership between, you know, corporations and the FBI, InfraGuard. It's a good place. Depending on what industry you're in, they send out these flash alerts for things that are going on. But generally, there's not one place. Anything big, you're going to get from many different avenues. You just have to kind of spread your reading across many different things, from security reports to just the regular news reports, and you'll generally be able to stay up on it. And then your technology vendors will keep you up on all the new, latest and greatest software and technology out there.
John?
And the last thing I'd add to that is don't discount your peers in the same industry. On the business side, I remember, you know, as banks, we would compete, but within the trenches of security, within the trenches of IT, relied very heavily on the peers within our own industry because we were seeing similar things, but from different points of view in different companies. And so we were very active in the ISAC, for example, for the financial services industry, where, yeah, our brands might compete, but at the end of the day, we're all trying to protect our own companies with the similar threats. And so I spent a lot of time talking with my industry peers at the same time.
You guys, the security industry is a close-knit community. We've grown from the secret in the back of the lab to now a seat at the executive table. It's taken a long time to get there. It's taken a long time to get your board and your CEO and others to care about security the way they do today. So in listening to these guys, it's just so refreshing to hear the conversation shift towards business acumen, so our security leaders can get their point across in a way that's taken like you care about the health of the business rather than just pushing perhaps the old geeky agenda forward to make things more secure. To me, that's the secret sauce, because you can sit with these guys all day long, and executives all day long, and if you can't make a business case for the reason, and usually that ties right back down to dollars, these initiatives that we're talking about advancing aren't going to happen. They're going to find a way to say no. So as you get smarter at Converge and other shows, and you can bring more business acumen to the table, this agenda will move forward. I'm glad that Converge let us talk about business a little bit as this show grows up as well. So thanks a lot, and thanks to all you for coming. Thanks. And we're done.